What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? PolyTalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on PolyTalk.
Search up PolyTalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Thinking about my own mortality, sometimes I get really angry because I think like, oh my gosh, I've got so much to live. I've got so much to do. Yeah. And it just feels like my timeline is just getting shorter each time.
I still feel that there's, regardless of what cancer diagnosis, that there is still a stigma and it's still taboo in our communities to talk about these things.
We don't really have screening methods that can pick out the ovarian cancer. So I guess you could call it a silent killer.
There are few words that feel as heavy as the word cancer. All cancers come with immense challenges, but ovarian cancer is especially devastating. And when it comes to the Pacific, comparatively speaking, this cancer has particularly high rates of mortality. I'm Natasha Metten. Sisters, let's talk about ovarian cancer. What are the signs and symptoms we should look out for and what we can do to reduce our risk of developing it? When Tongan woman Alisi Jack Kaufusi was first diagnosed with ovarian cancer, at the age of 24, it came as a big shock. Speaking with Melissa Makin from Pacific Soul, she says it was all-consuming.
Pretty much had to stop working as a flight attendant. I had to give it up and focus solely on my health with chemotherapy and surgeries. So I made the decision to stop being a flight attendant, and that was quite hard. I felt angry about my own mortality. Like, thinking about my own mortality, sometimes I get really angry because I think like, oh my gosh, I've got so much to live. I've got so much to do. It feels like my timeline is just getting shorter each time. And that I feel like sometimes I'm running out of time. That, oh my gosh, I've got to do this. I've got to do that. But I have to bring myself back and ground myself, because then when I do that, I tend to miss what's right in front of me because I'm so focused on my mortality, the knowing of it, the conscious of it, that I have this disease and that I have no control over it, and that one day, yes, it will eventually kill me. Whereas if I didn't know, if it was the unknown, then I think I'll be okay. But it's the knowing. It's the knowing.
Dr. Mary Rose Bagita is an obstetrician gynecologist at Port Moresby General Hospital. She also recently completed a Master's of Clinical Research at the University of Melbourne. Dr. Bagita, how difficult is it to detect ovarian cancer?
It's not an easy cancer to diagnose because most women will present late. And in the early stages of ovarian cancer, women do not have symptoms. So we say they're asymptomatic, and so therefore the tumor is growing within without women knowing that they have a cancer. So the symptoms that come are usually much later on. And then we don't really have screening methods that can pick out the ovarian cancer. So it's, I guess you could call it a silent killer. And as opposed to things like cervical cancer, there's screening methods that you can pick up before it becomes a cancer. But this is not the case with ovarian cancers because it's a bit more complicated, especially in our Pacific Island and third world countries, we really don't have the resources to pick up cancers early and ovarian cancer because of its natural progression, where most women will not know that they have the cancer. So at the Port Moresby General Hospital, ovarian cancers is the second most common reason for cancer admissions to our gynecology unit. This is after cervical cancers. So we do see quite a large number of ovarian cancers, but I guess the awareness of ovarian cancers is not as good as the awareness that we have on cervical cancer.
Yeah. And what should women be on the lookout for?
Okay, well, that's a good question. And I think before we come to what to look out for, it's good to know maybe some risk factors that might put you at much higher risk of getting ovarian cancers. So some of these risks are age, especially over 50 and higher over age 65. Also, if you have a family history of a mother or sister, especially who's had ovarian cancer or other cancers that are related, like breast, uterine. When we look at Pacific Island nations, we have high incidence rates among the Polynesian countries, but also high mortality rates amongst Micronesia, Polynesia, and Melanesia. So why do we have this high rates in incidence, mainly in high-income countries and also in Polynesia? And it's thought to be due to the changing lifestyle and the current lifestyle that people live in high-income countries.
And from your experience, is there anything to help to prevent it?
Okay, so this is when we come to the risk factors that can help you to reduce your risk. Some risk factors we cannot help because we're women and it runs in the family. But there are some risk factors that we can help to reduce our own risk. And that is if you're smoking, reduce smoking. If you're drinking alcohol every day, reduce or cut out the alcohol, the wine, because that really improves the risk reduction and increasing physical activity. So you also reduce your risk of ovarian cancer if you're very physically active. If you're overweight and obese, especially, is to do things that will cut down your weight. And if you're diabetic, hypertensive, have lipid problems, to get those treated. And also, the lifestyle changes, to change the lifestyle so that not only we need to reduce the risk of ovarian cancer, but also reduce and may possibly, overturn the diabetes, hypertension, and all those lifestyle diseases.
Dr. Bagita, because of, the limited health services that are available, or in some cases, the accessibility to these health services in Papua New Guinea, and I'm pretty sure it's similar across most Pacific countries, where does this leave women who do have ovarian cancer?
Yeah, it's a concern, especially for low-resource settings like, any third world country, including ours. And I think the main thing is, because the symptoms of ovarian cancer are usually pretty vague, but there are some symptoms, there are some things that women can look out for that sort of have a higher correlation with the likelihood that it might be ovarian cancer, and, make women go earlier to seek health services. So these are things like feeling like you have a lump in the tummy, or your tummy's feeling a bit bigger than usual. Maybe the skirts are not fitting, like you can't button or zipper up the skirts anymore, or the dresses are not fitting, you know, that kind of thing. So your tummy area is getting bigger, maybe feeling bloated or just losing appetite. And one of the other main things is if you have someone in your family, your female relatives who have had either ovarian cancer or breast cancer or uterine or endometrial cancers, when you combine all these things, then that's when you should be seeking for further medical advice. The thing about these talks is sometimes we talk about signs and symptoms, and a lot of the symptoms, also symptoms of other disease, you know, processes. So women feel quite a lot of anxiety, like, okay, my tummy feels like a bit big. Maybe I have ovarian cancer. But it's true, it might be the case, but sometimes I'm just putting maybe a few more symptoms together, and all that will help us make a better pathway to getting a diagnosis. Because there are also other symptoms that are really not specific for ovarian cancer, like just having diarrhea or abdominal pain or just some change in. Those symptoms can be also related to other disease processes, but it's important that if you do have someone in the family with any of those cancers I mentioned, if you are overweight or obese, have diabetes, high blood pressure, and the other things we mentioned, it's good to have a checkup if you're worried about your tummy becoming a bit bigger than it normally is.
And have you had any case studies where a woman has had an early detection and had treatment and has survived?
Yeah, so we do see a good number of women who come to us at the stage where the cancer can be operated upon. So when it's not too advanced, then we can do surgery and remove the tumor, and after that give chemotherapy. Then the outcome is reasonable. So it depends on also what the type of ovarian cancer they come with. So there are some ovarian cancers that have a better outcome than other ovarian cancers. And if they come with a smaller lump and that's not spread too far, then the outcome is a lot better. But we don't have like a proper register follow-up system. So sometimes women will come, we know a few women who will come and they feel so much better after the surgery. And they're feeling much better after the first or second round of chemotherapy, and then they don't come back again. So those ones who don't come back and we cannot follow them up, and those are the ones we don't know what has happened to them. So yeah, follow-up is an issue. We don't have that information. And the ones that do come back, we have seen a few, this is just anecdotal, well, few women who have come back that you meet that have survived. And again, it depends on how soon they sent to us or referred or present themselves.
Mm-hmm. As you've said, the survival rate from ovarian cancer is really low. So many women are in palliative care. Can you explain what this is?
Okay, so because of the nature and the late diagnosis and all that, sometimes it's beyond surgery. We cannot remove the full tumor. And because of that, it's not possible to give chemotherapy or other treatments. So then we provide palliative care, which is just making women comfortable and talking with the relatives to inform them that there's nothing much further that we can do now, but we can try to make life as comfortable as possible for the woman. So this will include things like pain relief, good pain relief, so that they're not constantly in pain, that they're able to have some sleep, reasonable sleep, having sometimes the tummy so full of fluid that we might go for just, you know, releasing some pressure by removing some fluid in the tummy and having family support, I'd say. So it's just about making women as comfortable as possible, trying to give them a little bit better quality of life before they reach the end of their life.
You're listening to Sisters Let's Talk. That was Dr. Mary Rose Bagita, a gynecologist from Port Moresby General Hospital. Although ovarian cancer is often incurable, having the best quality of life you can have isn't just at the end stage of palliative care. You can survive for a number of years, and having good support throughout your journey is key. For Alisi Jack-Kaufusi, her family has been a big source of love and motivation over the years.
All together, there's seven of us. I've got five sisters, one brother, but I'm actually adopted out to my auntie and uncle. So I did grow up with my siblings, but I didn't because I grew up in a different household. I grew up as an only child. So having their support was very important to me, especially my parents. I am very close with my parents. I'm just thinking back, Mom would always say, it's going to make me emotional. She would say, we need you. You know, Dad and I have lived our lives around, like, you are our life, you know. So I guess when they say that to me, it's like that message to keep going.
While family and community support is crucial for anyone who has a cancer diagnosis, it's particularly critical for more advanced diagnoses such as ovarian cancer. However, not everyone is fortunate to have the family or community support they need. Belinda Chen is the CEO of Fiji Cancer Society. She says they not only try to raise awareness about cancer, but also fill the gaps in support.
We see that it's our women that are requiring a lot of support. And there's some, you know, who have been abandoned by their husbands, which is, I guess, normal for us here in the Pacific Islands. Once you have a cancer diagnosis, you know, your partner, you just ups and leaves you with the children.
And what kind of support is your organization able to offer women, especially those who have low incomes?
We try and understand what their economic background is like. So if they don't have the means, then we offer the transportation services. Also, we're able to refer them to social welfare if they're not working, but yet they have children. We're really grateful to the Ministry of Women and Children to fast-track some of our social welfare recipients. So we try and help them. But initially, before that help is given by government or by the Ministry of Women, we're able to support them through transportation and whatever services we have available.
And what other services are you able to offer?
So we have a wide range of services that we offer. For those who are in palliative, there is home visitation and palliative support. So in terms of support, you're looking at, you know, just your day-to-day things, diapers, personal hygiene packs. We have mobility devices. We have hospital bed. We also have medical oxygen, which we give out. And then there's medication, usually medication that is not available on the essential drug list that we have. but also medication that is available on the drug list, the essential drug list, but is not in stock. Yeah. There are times when we are asked to procure chemotherapy drugs to assist the women and ensure that they continue with their chemotherapy, because we don't want these women to miss out. We also are a survivors market day, where we have, you know, just our survivors network all get together and do their own activities. We also reach out to our survivors to help the women navigate their way through that their cancer journey. At times, it is not a counselor or it is not a medical person that would be able to help them navigate their journey. It's a lived experience of a patient that would make things a lot more easier for them, allow them to navigate their way, you know, very easily, and give them a sense of hope, and give them faith to go on their journey. So we have our survivors network, and then there are times when, you know, when they're in palliative, that they require transportation in an ambulance just to get them home and to get them taken care of by their family members very comfortably. And there is no way we can let our patients or let our women, you know, just transition into the next life very uncomfortably. And so we need to ensure that, you know, our women have access to comfortable quality of life as they transition out of this world.
As we've heard, because ovarian cancer often starts without symptoms and there aren't early detection tests available, patients often present very late when it's incurable. How does your organization help raise awareness about cancer to help people catch it early or access services when they already have a diagnosis?
We do it through a community presentation. So the communities would range from church communities, women's church groups, just women's interest group. Also get invited to corporates, and it's normally initiated by women. So yeah, raising awareness within our communities and just letting them know what the signs and symptoms and what is the referral pathway they have. We also talk about the treatment that's available locally, which is really not much, but the main thing is that, you know, presenting early. I still feel that there's, regardless of what cancer diagnosis, that there is still a stigma and it's still taboo in our communities to talk about these things. But we've been pushing awareness, signs and symptoms, you know, going out to communities, doing it on air, and just letting them know.
That was Belinda Chen, the CEO of Fiji Cancer Society. Through social media, Alisi Jekaufusi seeks to raise awareness about ovarian cancer by documenting her own journey. And even though ovarian cancer comes with immense challenges, Alisi often highlights the positive and hopeful things in her life, as well as the tough days. She's also devised an exciting plan.
I was inspired by a very good friend of mine, Chloe, and she has bowel cancer. And she has this bucket list, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's so cool. So I was inspired by her, and I thought maybe by doing this bucket list, it will give me hope, as in something to look forward to. Because before, it was just always fight or flight mode with next treatment, the next scan, the next appointment. I was always focused on that. Whereas now I've got this bucket list and it's like, oh my gosh, okay, yes, okay, I want to cross this off. I want to do this. So if anything, this list has brought more positivity. But in saying that, to be really honest and transparent, sometimes I can actually get quite upset about having this bucket list. because it reminds me of my reality. You know, then I think, oh, okay, if I didn't have cancer, then I guess I wouldn't have had this bucket list. But because I have cancer, I have this bucket list. It's bittersweet. I also don't like that I've come to this point in my life that something bad like this or extreme had to happen in my life where it's like, oh my gosh, I need to do these things. I need to live. Whereas, well, we really shouldn't wait until something like this happens to us. We should just be living and doing the things we want to do.
Although Alisi has many aspirations, she's had to make adjustments with her bucket list to make it more manageable.
I've always wanted to try like a cooking class. So I booked myself and my very good friend from, we're still friends from primary school. We're going to do a cooking class and learn how to cook Thai food because I love Asian cuisines. We're going to learn how to cook some red curry, prawn curries. And there's a few other things like whale watching. Oh, well, it wasn't whale watching. I wanted to swim with the whales, but I have this line that's in my body. I can swim, but I can't submerge myself into the water. So I can't swim with the whales anymore. It was just really upsetting. So the closest thing I can do to get close to the whales is whale watching. So there's little things on there like go to Tangalooma. My overseas trips, I'm unable to do at the moment. That's been put on hold. I'm just waiting for the green light.
Alisis adds that although her journey has been extremely difficult, it's also taught her gratitude.
Just to embrace my body and appreciate my body a lot more, to be thankful that my body, I always think of my body because if it wasn't for my body, then I probably wouldn't be here, but that my body was able to tolerate with all what it's gone through. So it's just embracing and being appreciative of what I've got now.
Thank you so much for joining me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk on ABC Radio Australia, our weekly show by Pacific Island Women for Pacific Island Women, where we get together to talk about the issues that are important to us. I'd like to thank our guests, Alisi Jack Kaufusi, Dr. Mary Rose Bagita, and Belinda Chen. Although there are many things out of our control when it comes to ovarian cancer, like our family history and having ovaries, there are some things we can do to help reduce our risk of cancer, like keeping healthy, eating well, exercising, and limiting alcohol and smoking. Even recent studies from the University of Sydney has also shown that those who use the oral contraceptive pill for over 5 years and others who had their tubes tied also lowered their risk of developing ovarian cancer, especially among Pacific Island women. And remember, if you have a number of the symptoms, as Dr. Mary Rose Bagita mentioned, it's best to get checked out by a healthcare professional. If you've missed an episode on the show, catch up on our podcast. Just search for Sisters Let's Talk wherever you get your podcasts or key us into your favorite search engine. Sisters Let's Talk is presented by me, Natasha Metten. Our producer is Rachel Bongiorno, and Faleangafulu Inga Stunzna is our executive producer. Sisters Let's Talk is produced on Darumbal, Yagara and Turubo land and the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. And we pay respects to elders past and present.